يا أيها الذين آمنوا أنفقوا مما رزقناكم من قبل أن يأتي يوم لا بيع فيه ولا خلة ولا شفاعة والكافرون هم الظالمون.
All you who believe, spend out of what we have provided you before there comes a day when there will be no buying and selling, and no friendship and intercession will be of any use. And they who disbelieve, they indeed, they are the wrongdoers. O you who believe, spend out of what we have provided you. This means spending in the way of God. The instruction given here is that those who have adopted the cause of the true faith should undertake financial sacrifices for its sake. They indeed, they are the wrongdoers. Here, the expression "they who disbelieve" signifies either those who have refused to obey God and held their property to be dearer than God's good pleasure, or those who did not believe in the day of which they had been warned, or those who cherished the false illusion that in the hereafter they would somehow be able to secure their salvation, and that their association with men devoted to God would stand them in good stead, for they would intercede with God on their behalf.
الله لا إله إلا هو الحي القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
Allah, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist, there is no God but He. Neither slumber seizes Him, nor sleep. To Him belongs all that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth. Who is there who might intercede with Him, save with His leave? He knows what lies before them and what is hidden from them, whereas they cannot attain to anything of His knowledge, save what He wills them to attain. His dominion overspreads the heavens and the earth, and their upholding wearies Him not. He is all high, all glorious. Allah, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist, there is no God but He. Irrespective of the number of gods or objects of worship set up by ignorant people, the fact remains that Godhead in its entirety belongs exclusively to the Eternal Being, who is indebted to no one for His existence. In fact, He is not only self-existent, but upon Him rests the entire order of the universe. He alone wields all sovereign authority over His dominion. None shares either His attributes or His power and might, and no one has the same claims against the creatures as He. Hence, if anywhere in the heavens or the earth someone sets up anything or anybody as an object of worship and service, ilah, either instead of or in addition to the one true God, this amounts to declaring war on reality. Neither slumber seizes Him, nor sleep. This is a refutation of the ideas of those who, in formulating their concepts of God, are inclined to consider God analogous to their own imperfect selves and hence ascribe to God the weaknesses characteristic of human beings. An instance at hand is the famous biblical statement that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day He rested. To Him belongs all that is in the heavens and all that is in the earth. To God belong the heavens and the earth and everything therein. There is no one who shares anything with God in governance, either of the heavens or of the earth. Any conceivable being other than God would necessarily be a part of the universe and thus belong to and be a subject of God rather than His partner and equal.
Who is there who might intercede with him, save with his leave? This is a refutation of the ideas of those polytheists who consider either saints, angels, or other beings to be so influential with God that if they were adamant in demanding something of him, their demand would prevail. They are being told that, far from anyone having the power to impose his will on God, none, not even the greatest prophets and the most highly esteemed angels, would dare utter one word in the majestic court of the Lord unless they are expressly permitted to do so, save what he wills them to attain. Here, another blow is struck against polytheism. On the basis of the concept of God's unlimited sovereignty and omnipotence, it was stressed in the foregoing verses that no one shares independently in God's governance of the universe, and no one is so powerful with God that his intercession would decisively influence his judgment. The same point is stressed here, but in a different manner. It is pointed out that no one possesses the knowledge that would enable him to comprehend the order of the universe and the considerations underlying it, so no one can legitimately interfere in its governance. The knowledge of human beings, of jinn, of angels, and of all other creatures is limited and imperfect. No one's knowledge embraces all the facts of the universe. If someone did have the right to interfere, even in only a part of the universe, and if his suggestions were of necessity to be put into effect, the entire order of the universe would be disrupted. Creatures are incapable of understanding what is best for them and do not have the capacity to know how best the universe should be governed. It is God alone who knows everything. His dominion overspreads the heavens and the earth. The Arabic term kursi signifies sovereignty, dominion, and authority. The word kursi has been variously interpreted by Muslim scholars. The literal meaning is obvious. It signifies that which one sits on. Scholars have differed, however, as to whether the word has been used in the Quran literally or figuratively. They have also disagreed whether the kursi and arsh, which occur in the Quran, have one and the same meaning or are different. The main opinions expressed by the scholars are the following. 1. That kursi signifies God's knowledge, a view attributed to Ibn Abbas. 2. That is identical with arsh, throne, a view attributed to Hassan al-Basri. 3. That it signifies God's power. 4. In opposition to such views, a large number of scholars insist that kursi should be considered a reality rather than be understood figuratively. In addition to many earlier scholars, this view was vigorously championed by Ibn Taymiyyah. It should be remembered, however, that Ibn Taymiyyah and others who hold this opinion side by side with affirming that kursi is a reality also emphasize that man has no knowledge about the nature and modality of kursi, and that it ought to be treated as something unique, being related to God, who is unique both in his essence and attributes. It is interesting to note that Sayyid Qutb, martyred 1386 after Hijri, a contemporary of Maududi and one of the most influential Islamic thinkers of our time, has interpreted the verse exactly as Maududi did. He is all high, all glorious. This verse is generally known as the verse of the throne, and it provides in one piece a knowledge of God without parallel. The question that arises here is, what is the occasion for describing the Lord of the universe and his attributes? In order to appreciate this, one should rehearse the discourse beginning with verse 243 and continuing up to this point. In this discourse, the believers were urged to strive with their lives and belongings to establish the true faith, and were warned to get rid of the weaknesses which had characterized the conduct of the Israelites. A fundamental fact about war, that victory and success do not depend upon superiority in either numbers or weapons, was then indicated. They depend rather on faith, fortitude, discipline, and firm resolution. Thereafter, the divine wisdom underlying fighting was disclosed, namely that God removes one set of people by means of another in order to maintain the good administration of the world.
For were one group's dominance to be assured in perpetuity, the lives of all other human beings would become miserable.
This was followed by the clarification of a misunderstanding which often arises in the minds of ignorant people. This misunderstanding arose from the false assumption that God has sent His prophets so that all diversity and disagreement might come to an end. The people who accepted this premise, however, saw considerable diversity and disagreement, and were aware that falsehood existed side by side with truth. They were agitated by the thought that this state of affairs might suggest helplessness on God's part, that He had failed to stamp out the evils He wanted to. In reply to this, it was pointed out that it was not God's will to compel all human beings to follow one and the same way. Had it been so, man could not have deviated from the course set for him by God. This observation was followed by a passing reference to the subject with which the discourse opened. Finally, the point is made that no matter how many divergent beliefs, viewpoints, ways of life, and conduct exist in actual life, the reality underlying the order of the universe is the one stated in this verse, and it remains unaffected by the misconceptions of people. On the other hand, however, it is not God's purpose to compel people to accept it. Whoever rejects it will find the results harmful.
لا إكراه في الدين قد تبين الرشد من الغي فمن يكفر بالطاغوت ويؤمن بالله فقد استمسك بالعروة الوثقى لا انفصام لها والله سميع عليم.
There is no compulsion in religion. The right way now stands clearly distinguished from the wrong. Hence, he who rejects the evil ones and believes in Allah has indeed taken hold of the firm, unbreakable handle. And Allah, whom he has held for support, is all-hearing, all-knowing. There is no compulsion in religion. Deen here signifies the belief about God embodied in the above verse of the throne and the entire system of life which rests upon it. The verse means that the system of Islam embracing belief, morals, and practical conduct cannot be imposed by compulsion. These are not things to which people can be yoked forcibly. Hence, he who rejects the evil ones. Literally, taghut means anyone who exceeds his legitimate limits. In the Quranic terminology, however, it refers to the creature who exceeds the limits of his creatureliness and arrogates to himself godhead and lordship. There are three stages of man's transgression and rebellion against God. The first stage is that one acknowledges in principle that obedience to God is right, but disregards it in practice. This is fisk, transgression. The second stage is that one not only disobeys, but also rejects obedience in principle, and thus either refuses to become the subject of anyone at all, or adopts someone other than God as the object of service and devotion. This is kufr, infidelity. The third stage is that one not only rebels against one's Lord, but also imposes one's own will, in disregard of the will of God, on God's world and God's creatures. Anyone who reaches such a point is termed taghut, and no one can be a true believer in God unless the authority of such a taghut, evil one, is rejected.
Allah waliyyu alladhina amanu yukhrijuhum min adh-dhulumati ila an-nur والذين كفروا أولياؤهم الطاغوت يخرجونهم من النور إلى الظلمات أولئك أصحاب النار هم فيها خالدون.
Allah is the guardian of those who believe and brings them out of every darkness into light. And those who disbelieve, their guardians are the evil ones. They bring them out of light into all kinds of darkness. These are destined for the fire, and there shall they abide.
and brings them out of every darkness into light. The darkness mentioned here means the darkness of ignorance, which throws man off the path of salvation and well-being and directs his energies and efforts to wrong directions in defiance of reality. Light here means the knowledge of truth, with the help of which man comes to know his own reality and that of the universe. This knowledge also shows him the purpose of his life, and thus leads him consciously to adopt the right way. And those who disbelieve, their guardians are the evil ones. Here, Taghut has a plural connotation. It implies that by turning away from God, a man is subjected not to the tyranny of one, but to the tyranny of many Taghut, evil one. One of these is Satan, who throws up new temptations and allurements. Another potential Taghut, transgressor, is man's own animal self, which seeks to subjugate him to his appetites and desires. There are many more taghlut in the world outside oneself, one's wife and children, one's relatives, one's family and one's community, one's friends and acquaintances, one's social environment and one's people, one's leaders and guides, one's government and rulers are all potential taghlut, each one of whom seeks to have his purposes served. Man remains subjected to these innumerable masters throughout his life, not knowing precisely whom he should please and whose displeasure he should avoid.